You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sam.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today we'll continue our coverage of the 63rd anniversary of the United States atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Last week, we talked with Jackie Cabasso of Western States Legal Foundation. Jackie works on issues of nuclear disarmament and is involved in petitioning Congress to declare August 6th Nuclear Disarmament Day. That show is archived at the website www.raisingsandradio.org, and I invite you to take a listen. Jackie goes into a lot of the history of the nuclear disarmament movement. This week, I'm going to continue that coverage, and we'll go to the opening reception of a very special exhibit provided by the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation on display in Oakland City Hall in California. The speakers include a Nagasaki bomb survivor, Nobuaki Hanaoka. I'll also end the show with an interview with Dutch van Kirk, the navigator of the Enola Gay, which, as you probably know, was the plane that dropped the bomb over Hiroshima. Let's listen to the opening reception of the exhibit.
I'm Jean Kwan. I am the Council President Pro Tem of the Oakland City Council, and I'm happy to host the exhibit here today. And when the group came to me, I don't think they realized that this has actually been an issue in one of my other lives. Today I've had the pleasure of talking to student interns, and when you talk to them about anything that's older than 10 years, they really think you're part of history. And so I get to talk a little bit about what the issue of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has meant for me, growing up as an Asian American, as somebody who was very involved in the peace movement during my earlier years when Reverend Hanaoka was young and a peace activist, was a radical for the Japanese community, a radical peace minister. And when my husband and I were very much involved at UC Berkeley in rediscovering our history as founders of the Asian American Studies Department at UC Berkeley and part of the Third World Strike. And when we were in the depth of, for what my generation was the war, and unfortunately there have been many wars since then. And so today it struck me when I was talking to these high school students and I was talking to them about the war, and they looked at me puzzled and they realized that there was a war before Iraq. There are different defining things for different generations, and clearly for mankind, Hiroshima was the defining moment. As a young student at the University of California looking at our history, many of us were involved in the anti-war movement, and we could feel some of the premises of having little value for life, some of the premises that worry us even today about the decision that was made on Hiroshima, the value of life, particularly if that life looks different than you, has different beliefs than you. It is something that I think that each generation we have to look at what are our motives when we launch wars that now are so clean, seem so clean, and where there's such a control of the media, where the pictures that we see here of the war and destruction, we don't get to see those from Iraq, but they happen every day. But they've been pretty much illuminated by the control of the media, so we don't even see the dead bodies of the young men who come back to be buried in our own nation, much less the death and destruction that we wage thousands of miles away. As Asian Americans, the way I met Reverend Hanaoka was that one of our professors, Yuji Uchioka, was a good friend of one of the Hibakusha who worked for the media, and they brought an exhibit. He had this exhibit, and he wanted to find a place where we could exhibit it. And because we were doing Asian American history, we had done other things, we talked the Japan Trade Center into letting us put this exhibit up, and they had no idea what we were putting up. And it became very controversial, and I felt particularly a little in the middle because here I'm a Chinese American, and I'm talking about a Japanese American issue. And when we put the exhibit up, we met and found out that there were hundreds of Hibakusha in the Bay Area. And when I went to our sister city, Fukuoka, it really struck me because I had known intellectually that a lot of Japanese Americans were from the Hiroshima region, and that Nagasaki was the great Christian center in Japan. So many Japanese Americans who had ties with the United States ended up being victims, they or their families. But what really struck me is that Fukuoka, our sister city, with whom I welcomed hundreds of students over the year, literally was in the middle between Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and in fact, Fukuoka was the original target. But they were lucky. It was cloudy over the port that day, and the U.S. really wanted to have good pictures of what damage they did, and they chose Hiroshima instead because it was clear over Hiroshima. But when I think about the hundreds and thousands of students that I've welcomed over the years in our exchange students, that it could have been Fukuoka, and they're very, very, very close to each other. We're very proud to be one of the cities who has stood for peace and during many years. So we're very proud to be one of the cities for peace. And I'm going to ask Keith Carson to join us. Keith has been a good friend of the city and the warrior on the war of the budget cuts and trying to protect the poor in our health care program. So I'm very pleased to ask him to join us here.
First, I want to say thanks very much to Jane for really being the host for this evening's event, which is a very powerful, powerful event. If you have a chance to walk around and see the pictures and the images, unfortunately, of what happened about 62 years ago, come a few days from now. And so I want to say thank you for your leadership on the Oakland City Council on so many issues, and especially the issues of health care and others that we join together on, and so thank you. I would be remiss if I didn't say I appreciate this opportunity to say a few things, and I appreciate the fact that that both Phyllis Olin, who is the president, and then Jackie Cabasso, the executive directress of the Western States Legal Foundation, people both whom I've known for a long time, I want to say publicly, thank you not only for tonight, but thank you for so, so many years being strong, strong educators, advocates, activists in the area of peace, but even more so in the area of disarmament. And you've always maintained your steadfastness even when many of us, sometimes myself, have been wavering back and forth. You've always been very consistent, and I want to say thank you so much for that leadership. They say it was about 200,000 individuals, 200,000 individuals who died that day, those 2 days in which bombs were dropped in Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And that was after the U.S. had been bombing Japan for several months consistently. So we really don't know how many people died directly as a result of this, the dropping of the bombs that took place in Japan. And those lives were lost, and many countless other lives have been totally destroyed as a result of that act that the United States imposed on Japan. And as I was walking around looking at the pictures, I recalled a story that I read a long, long time ago. And it was about a young Japanese girl who was born 2 years before they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And Sadaka Sakaya, Sadaka was a young girl at the age of two. And after the bombs fell, she was growing up. And it was noted in the area where she lived that she would probably grow up to be this great athlete. She was a runner. She was a great athlete. But at the age of 11, Sadaka contracted leukemia, what they call the atomic bomb disease in those days. And when she found out about it, she was telling her best friend, "I've gotten leukemia, and I'm not too sure I'm going to live that long." And her best friend said, "Well, I heard this old ancient story that if you fold 1,000 cranes, that you would be granted a wish. And she began immediately folding cranes, a symbol of peace. And she did fold over 1,000 cranes before she died at the age of 12. That life was dedicated towards peace. While that wish could have been, give me health, let me live longer, it was about peace. And we know that many people today have followed the symbolically folding of cranes and the releasing of cranes around the world as an international gesture of peace. And that's really what the Western States Legal Foundation has been about. It's been consistently about focusing in on educating people, letting people see, like we are today, pictorially, but also informationally, what the impact of war is on individuals directly, indirectly, for years and years and years to follow. It was, interestingly enough, one of our great presidents, John F. Kennedy, who in 1961 made a profound statement about war. And what he said was that mankind must put an end to war, or war would put an end to mankind. War will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector, and I want you to hear this, Jackie and Phyllis in particular, war will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector enjoys the same reputation and prestige that the warrior does today. Again, I hope that this moment of reflection is one that will recommit all of us to do more to end war. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And unfortunately, the lead warrior for peace in City Hall is not here today. However, he is represented today by Leslie Littlejohn from the mayor's office.
Good afternoon. I am very pleased to be here on behalf of Mayor Ron Dellums, and I can't begin to say what I would even mildly think that he would say in regards to the pursuit of peace and justice in this world. But what I can do is just tell you that he is sorry that he can't be here, and I know that he feels very strongly about ending war and forging peace. And to the organizers, the Western States Legal Foundation, please just keep up your strong fight and advocacy. I'd also like to read a proclamation that we are offering this afternoon from the City of Oakland. Witnessing to History Day, on behalf of the City of Oakland, I extend sincere gratitude to the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation for the tremendous contributions they have made to honor the 63rd anniversary of the United States atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For it is through visual art, literature, motion pictures, and photography that the memory of those who died and the spirit of those who survived live on. I encourage all residents of Oakland and the Greater Bay Area to visit this magnificent exhibit and hope that people of all ages and nationalities can see this as a profound reminder of the tragedies that can be created when the pursuit of military power diverts resources that could be used to build a world that is fair, just, and serves the interests of all humanity. Therefore, I, Ronald V. Dellums, Mayor of the City of Oakland, do hereby declare Friday, August 1st, 2008 as Witness to History Day in the City of Oakland and encourage its recognition and remembrance by all its citizens. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. Next speaker, or we're just going to have two more, is the person who made this possible. The Western States Legal Foundation, we're proud to say, is housed here in Oakland. and has been the U.S. coordinator of the Mayors for Peace program. And I have to say, I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki for the 60th anniversary, and it had always, because my husband and I had worked with the Friends of Hibakusha and had worked on the medical care for them, it always had been one of my great wishes, so I was able to combine that with a trip to our sister city. And I got to see a lot of the things that are pictured here in this exhibit. But I was interested, very interested, saying, oh, look, there's this petition signed by a couple of U.S. mayors, and that's gone from a few hundred U.S. mayors to, now I understand, over 2,000. So I'm pleased to introduce Jackie Cabasso, who is responsible for the growth of that movement.
Thank you all so very, very much for coming tonight. There are so many things I want to say, but I want to thank Jean, of course, and I want to thank the mayor very much. It's really meaningful to me and to Western States Legal Foundation to be here in this building today, because we have a long history here in Oakland as what I like to call Oakland's premier nuclear disarmament advocacy organization for more than 25 years now. I want to remind you all, everybody may not realize this, that Oakland is a nuclear-free zone by city statute. Western States Legal Foundation was very involved in the creation of that ordinance, which is, to the best of our knowledge, the most comprehensive nuclear-free zone ordinance in the country. It restricts city investments in and purchases from companies that make nuclear weapons, provides for city designation of local routes for transportation of hazardous radioactive materials, and establishes a permitting process for nuclear weapons work in the city. And I don't think anyone has applied for a permit since 1992 to do that work in the city. This exhibit is brought to us by the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation, which set out to mount 101 of these exhibits in United States cities in 2008. They're actually far exceeding that number, but the number is based on the idea of at least two in each state and one in the District of Columbia. So we're also thankful to the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. Now, the reason that the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation is mounting this exhibit is because the Hibakusha, the survivors of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are growing older and more concerned that nuclear weapons will be used again. And they're kind of like, and they are the ones who have been the witnesses, who have experienced the unimaginable. And their concerns, I'm sorry to say, are well-founded, because while the numbers of nuclear weapons have gone down worldwide, they're not exactly low, folks, about 26,000 still in the world, about 10,000 in the U.S. arsenal, the United States and Russia still maintain their Cold War hair trigger alert postures. U.S. Trident submarines are still patrolling the world's oceans at the same rate as they were during the Cold War, ready to instantly target cities anywhere in the world within 30 minutes or less. The United States is actually spending about $6.5 billion a year just on its nuclear warhead programs, about $54 billion a year if you add in delivery systems. Now, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the overall U.S. military budget of about $711 billion, including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But $54 billion, the nuclear weapons budget with the delivery systems, is more than the entire military budget of all but four other countries in the world. And overall, U.S. military spending equals the rest of the world combined. So we have a problem. We have a problem here in our cities, which desperately need the money to provide for real human needs and human security, not national security defined by militarism. So the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation, which recognizes the unique role of cities, the unique place of cities. Cities now represent more than half of humanity. That was recognized by the United Nations last year. In other words, more than half of the population of the world lives in cities. And the United Cities and Local Governments, which is an international association of cities, has actually endorsed the Mayors for Peace campaign for the global elimination of nuclear weapons by the year 2020, which is actually a far more specific plan than the very aspirational and often quoted Henry Kissinger and George Shultz call for the creation of a vision of a world without nuclear weapons. Mayors for Peace are actually calling for a world without nuclear weapons. Let's skip the vision. Okay, there are now 130 U.S. members of Mayors for Peace. There are more than 2,300 in 130 countries around the world. It has grown from less than 600 member cities in 2003 under the dynamic leadership of the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And here in the United States, which is, I think, the most difficult country in the world to organize on this issue, in June, just last month, well, 2 months ago now, at its annual meeting in Miami, the prestigious U.S. Conference of Mayors unanimously adopted a far-reaching resolution put forward by Mayors for Peace entitled Support for the Elimination of All Nuclear Weapons by the Year 2020. The resolution recommends that the U.S. government urgently consider a specific proposal called the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Protocol, a framework agreement for the elimination of nuclear weapons, as a means of fulfilling the promise, which we never hear about in this country, of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty by the year 2020, thereby meeting the obligation found by the International Court of Justice in 1996 to conclude negotiations leading to nuclear disarmament in all its aspects under strict and effective international control. And that was the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and they have significant political clout in Washington, D.C. Of course, it wasn't reported in the news. You heard it here first. But I was there in Miami, and it did happen. And finally, I just want to say something else, which is, for years now, I have been, whenever I've gone to Japan, I have offered my own apology to the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for the U.S. atomic bombings. It is my belief, once I learned about nuclear weapons, which, by the way, I didn't learn about in high school in the United States at the time I was there, that nothing could have justified these holocausts that you are seeing the pictures of here today. And I think that eventually the United States is going to have to apologize. And I think it's a good sign, although insufficient, that the U.S. Congress this week apologized for slavery and the Jim Crow laws. And we should acknowledge that. Well, it took 140 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. It's been 63 years since the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I hope it's not going to take 140 years for an apology, but I do think it is necessary and appropriate. So thank you all again very much, and thank you very much to Mayor Dellums for this wonderful proclamation, Witness to History Day. Thank you.
So last but not least, I'm pleased to introduce Reverend Nobu Hananoka, and as I said, when I first met the Reverend, we were both younger, and you know, the Japanese community is a very polite community, and they were not quite sure what to do with this impolite discussion of war and tragedy. And it's interesting, as years have gone on, it is often that same feeling I sometimes get around the discussion around the war in Iraq, that we don't want to talk about the pain and we don't want to talk about the suffering, and we're a little bit too comfortable with the sanitized war, where we don't see the pictures of the harm and that the people who launched the weapons are literally thousands of miles away. Reverend Hananoka was an early pioneer of the peace movement in the Japanese community and has had congregations both here in Sacramento and San Francisco. And he's been a major supporter of the Hibakusha community, which is, I asked him today how many he thought there were left, when 20 years ago there may be 1,000, and today there may only be 300 or 400 voices left and in the United States. And this witness to what man can do to each other, and witnesses mostly for peace, is a very precious resource. So I'm so pleased to have him.
Thank you very much, Jean, and Jackie, for inviting me here. George Santamaria said that those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. It's been 63 years since the first atomic bombs, hopefully the last, were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was born on December 25th, Christmas Day, 1944. And every time I watch the movie White Christmas, you know, remember the first scene, the Christmas show, 1944 in Germany? And that was the time when I was born. That means I was 7.5 months old when the bombs were dropped. I don't remember anything. I don't really have any personal memories of the bombing. And the family didn't talk about it because they thought that if the family was exposed to radiation that day, the girls would not be able to get married. So even within the family, relatives, that was the subject that no one talked about until my brother died years later. My mother died when I was 6. And the following year, my sister died. And I remember, the only thing I remember about my mother and my sister was the fact that they were both sick in bed, as far back as I can remember. They looked pale, and they didn't talk much, and they really looked sick. I was the youngest of the family, and I was a baby, so I must have been the most vulnerable one to the effects of radiation. But to this day, I'm still alive. I'm alive, but you know, every time I catch a cold, I say to myself, maybe I have reached the end of my rope. The radiation may have finally caught up with me. So I grew up thinking like that. In fact, I overheard, kind of faint in my memories, but doctor telling my father that the baby in your family is not likely to live to be 10. I'm 63, as you can see. I'm as old as the atomic age. Thank you. You know, the United States developed atomic bombs knowing that Germans had already started the program. They wanted to counter the German effort so that it would become a symbolic political gesture to tell the Germans that Americans can develop equally destructive ultimate weapon. Well, Hitler's army was destroyed. Japan was sending the feelers out to come to some kind of agreement in terms of the terms of surrender. And Russia declared war against Japan. The United States had to finish the war as quickly as possible to keep the Russians out. So they dropped the bomb. Actually, without the bombs, Japan would have surrendered that summer. Why did we have to suffer so much? You know, I thought about it all the time. Well, after the end of the Second World War, Russians realized that those two bombs, atomic bombs, were dropped for the purpose of keeping the Russians out. The Russians felt that they had to develop their own nuclear weapons. So 4 years later, they successfully tested their first atomic bombs. Well, that, after that, the United States felt that we should develop more powerful weapons, the hydrogen bombs, in 4 years. U.S. successfully tested the first hydrogen bomb. The Hiroshima-Nagasaki bombs were only 20 kilotons. The hydrogen bomb that the U.S. developed was over 10 megatons. More powerful than all the bombs dropped on Great Britain during the war. Well, just one bomb. Well, the Soviet Union also decided to develop the hydrogen bomb of equal capacity. A year later, they announced that they had successfully tested their hydrogen bomb. You know, going back to the Nagasaki bombing, because we were not very close to the epicenter, our family was not affected by the blast or the fire. The so-called fission of the atoms, splitting of atoms, created tremendous energy. The first is a blast, 800 something miles per hour wind that knocked down just about everything within the mile radius, followed by a tremendous heat that ignited almost within a second, almost everything within a mile. In fact, near the epicenter of Nagasaki explosion was the largest Christian church in Asia with 12,000 members, Murakami Catholic Church. That day, 8,600 members of that church vaporized. The more deadly effects of the atomic bombs was the radioactive particles escaping into the atmosphere. After the bombs exploded, there was a rain, which we call black rain, contaminated with the radioactive fallout. What happened was most of the people were just destroyed. All the buildings, 90% of the buildings in the city of Hiroshima were destroyed. And that means hospitals were destroyed and doctors were killed. The fire department no longer existed. Who would take care of the survivors? The survivors remember processions of ghostly figures, you know, the skin peeling, eye bulging, and begging for water. Give me water, give me water. The radiation was the deadliest. By the end of the 1950, 250,000 people were killed. And it continued to kill. And we have no way to figure out how many were killed, because the radioactive materials released in the atmosphere, we don't know how far and where it traveled. Many, many more died. Today, our nuclear bombs are much more efficient, much more effective. And as early as 1965, the scientists realized that this is not a practical weapon because you can't actually use it. And if you use it, it becomes the weapon of global genocide. You can't really focus on the target, military target. It is the machine to kill indiscriminately. It is a murder machine. 1970, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed. That took an effect, and 128 nations had pledged never to develop nuclear weapons. And the countries that already had, at that point there were five nations, also pledged to reduce and eventually to eliminate the nuclear weapons, realizing how devastating, how inhumane and how cruel these bombs were. And yet, today the United States has 10,000 warheads. And our nuclear capabilities, the government told us, were a deterrent for other countries to attack the United States. But today, if you come to think of it, we attacked Iraq, saying that they were developing nuclear arsenals, which made the rest of the world insecure and fearful about the U.S. attacks. To defend themselves, many of the people outside the country began to feel that we have to develop nuclear weapons to defend ourselves from the U.S. attacks. If you want to stand up against the U.S. interest, you have to have the nuclear weapons. That's what many people are thinking. We have to stop that. We know when Iran or North Korea were developing nuclear arsenals, we get so nervous. But we don't realize how nervous the rest of the world is about the U.S. nuclear capabilities. We have to reduce dramatically, as quickly as possible, and eventually eliminate all of the nuclear weapons in the world. And it is very... You know, you never know what could happen to our existing weapons. Terrorists might want to steal it. Just recently, we heard a report that B-52 was flying over the U.S. continental U.S., not realizing that they had a nuclear warhead on the plane. Remember? Just recently, I heard the news that someone who had the red button to launch the nuclear arsenals was found asleep. You know, we are all humans. We make mistakes. We can't keep these weapons. One mistake, erroneous or mistaken launching of such weapons, will have a tremendous effect. Could kill millions. The war is a sin. We should prevent wars. We should commit ourselves to resolve all the conflicts peacefully. Instead of calling North Korea and Iran, Iraq, the axis of evil, we should start negotiating with them to calm the tensions, reduce the tensions, so that we could together, work together, to create a better, more peaceful world. Let us renew our commitment to the world, nuclear-free future.
That was Nobuaki Hanaoka speaking at the opening of the exhibit provided by the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation on display in City Hall Rotunda. It will be there until August 15th. Before we turn to the interview with Dutch van Kirk, the navigator of the Enola Gay, I wanted to read a message from Tadadoshi Akiba, the mayor of the city of Hiroshima and also the president of the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. He sent this message with the exhibition that is currently in the City Hall Rotunda. The information presented in this exhibit derives from an event that took place 62 years ago. We believe that event remains relevant to you today for two main reasons. First, the atomic bombings led to a dramatic change in consciousness. Hiroshima and Nagasaki experienced what felt like the end of the world. Whole families, neighborhoods, and communities vanished in seconds. The sheer magnitude of the destruction, horror, pain, and despair led to an understanding among the survivors that human beings can no longer resolve conflicts through contests of destructive power. Such contests can have no winners. They threaten our entire species. War is obsolete. Nuclear war is out of the question. This understanding remains ahead of its time. Most human beings still seem unable to grasp the concept of a totally inclusive world peace. We hope that this exhibition will help a few more members of the human family rise to that new level of consciousness and commit to our collective survival. Second, this exhibition is relevant because the horrific images it presents are more likely than ever to leap from history into our future. The nuclear threat did not end with the Cold War. Unfortunately, certain powerful people still harbor the delusion that nuclear weapons can guarantee security or further their fantasies of world domination. The U.S. and Russia, with thousands of nuclear warheads ready to launch on warning, still hold us all hostage to political competition. Some experts say we are at greater risk than ever of an accidental Holocaust and nuclear winter. More likely than global Holocaust, however, is a lowering of the threshold that has so far prevented nuclear violence. U.S. nuclear policy still retains actual planning for nuclear first use, even against nations with no nuclear weapons. On April 28, 2006, the Las Vegas Sun quoted Doug Bruder, head of the Counter Weapons of Mass Destruction Program for the Department of Defense, saying, "There are some very hard targets out there that right now it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to defeat with conventional weapons. Therefore, there are some that would probably require nuclear weapons." In June 2007, all of the front-running candidates for U.S. President, Republican and Democrat, stated that they would be willing to use tactical nuclear weapons to keep Iran from obtaining such a weapon. All such comments send chills down spines in Hiroshima. The Hibakusha, the A-bomb survivors, have been telling us for decades that human beings and nuclear weapons cannot coexist indefinitely. As long as they exist, nuclear weapons remain an obscenely expensive, criminally dangerous threat. Our greatest hope for this exhibition is that it will inspire you to spread the desire to be liberated from this threat. In the next 3 to 5 years, the human family will make a crucial decision. Will we eliminate nuclear weapons, or will we use them? The overwhelming majority of nations and people on this planet want the former. If the U.S. were to take the lead in a sincere global effort to find and eliminate all nuclear weapons and weapon-grade fissile material, we could be rid of them by 2020, when the nuclear age turns 75. We have lived too long in fear and hatred. We can't resolve the real problems we face by continuing to threaten each other with annihilation. We hope that you will make it clear to your leaders that you expect them, above all, to lead you toward a peaceful, just, and sustainable world free of nuclear weapons. Tadadoshi Akiba, mayor of the city of Hiroshima, and also president of the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. Now let's turn to an interview with Dutch van Kirk, the navigator of the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb over Hiroshima. But first, let's review the events of August 6th and 9th, 1945. I want to remind you that very early in the morning of August 6th, 1945, an American B-29 bomber, the Enola Gay, dropped an 8,900-pound atomic weapon that detonated 2,000 feet above the city of Hiroshima. Dubbed Little Boy, it leveled almost 90% of that city. On August 9th, another B-29 set out for the Japanese island of Kyushu. Foul weather diverted the flight, and the pilot dropped a larger device, codenamed Fat Man, on the city of Nagasaki, destroying about one-third of that city. Fat Man and Little Boy were actually quite different weapons. Little Boy, fueled by highly enriched uranium-235, was triggered by a simple gun mechanism. A small, slug-shaped piece of uranium was fired down a barrel into a larger cup-shaped piece. This elementary design generated a destructive force of about 15 kilotons, the equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. A more complex implosion-type device triggered Fat Man, and this consisted of a plutonium core surrounded by high explosives wired to explode simultaneously. The shock waves from these conventional explosions triggered the fission of the plutonium, which yielded a 22-kiloton explosion that would be equal to 22,000 tons of TNT. Let's listen to the voice of Dutch van Kirk, the navigator on the Enola Gay.
During those periods, why, if you were shot down as an airman, you went to a German prison camp. You didn't go into any old German prison camp and things of that type. So it was an honorable war and everything else, but still, you get killed. A lot of people get killed.
300,000 Americans.
Yes.
And 30 million people.
Yep, no question about it.
Yep. Which highlights your deed even more. The fact that...
We were just trying to end the war. Paul Tibbetts told me the first time he called me about joining the 509th, he said, Dutch, he said, you know, we're going to do something. He said, I can't tell you what it is. He says, but if it works, we're either going to end or significantly shorten the war. And he said, it'll mean going overseas again and that sort of thing. But he says, if you want to do it, he says, I'd like to have you as my group navigator. And... I was in New Orleans at the time, and he was on the phone, and I said, Paul's good enough for me. I says, what do I do now? He says, well, send your orders. Funny part about it was my orders were dated 2 days before his telephone call. So much for the volunteering.
Where did you train for the atomic bomb mission?
Wendover, Utah.
Oh, on the border of Nevada and Utah.
Yep, right there.
How big a group was it?
The 509th group had about 1,600 people, roughly.
How many planes were involved?
15 bombing airplanes, B-29s, special B-29s, stripped down B-29s, took all the guns out, all the turrets out, except the tail guns. And
was that for weight reasons?
It was to give us altitude and speed to get away from the bomb, and also the test that we had flown, that Paul had flown. Indicated that they couldn't get close to us anyhow at that altitude. Plus, the Japanese were beaten by that time. And
did they explain to you what the bomb could do, or what they thought it could do?
After the 16th, they came down. We had all the pictures. We had General Farrell there, who was a deputy commander to Groves. He came over and told us as much as he could. And Captain Parsons. They told us as much as they knew and as they could.
So you knew about radiation?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were told not to fly in the White Cloud, for example, because that was loaded with radiation.
So did you took the planes over before the bomb came over, or did you take it with you?
No. We took the planes over separately. Yeah. But just like any other group, the ground force went over on a ship, the planes flew over, and then various of our planes later on maybe flew parts of the bombs over and things of that type. But the major parts of the bombs went over on Indianapolis, and then with some of the casings and stuff we flew over.
That's another sad story.
Yeah. We also had six C-54s in our group for transport planes because a lot of the stuff we were hauling, a lot of the people we were hauling and everything else, they didn't want people to know where they were going and what they were doing.
Yeah, that was a highly secret mission. And you landed in Tinian, that was your base?
That was our base.
Did you fly any missions before the famous one?
I have one mission over here in the Pacific. I have 58 missions over Europe and one in the Pacific.
Big one.
It was the biggest.
And yet, it sounds as if it was your job. That's a mission. What do we got? Let's go.
It was. How else was I supposed to view it? You know, we prepared for it. We were confident we knew what we were doing. We were confident we knew the outcome and everything of that type. So why worry? And if I hadn't been dead already, why worry now? You know, the mission was a perfect mission. It went exactly according to plan. I was 12 seconds late getting over the target from the time we planned to drop it and things of this type. So everything went just perfectly. And
what was the plan after the bomb was dropped? Would it hit the ground or was it on a parachute?
It exploded at 1,800 feet, not a parachute, radar proximity fuse. It exploded about 1,800 feet above the ground. And we, of course, broke away because the bomb was going forward. We had to go the other way to put distance between it and us. And when it exploded, 43 seconds after it left the plane, all we saw was a bright flash in the plane. And then shortly thereafter, we got a bump, big, good old thump from it. And we all thought it was flak that had burst fairly close to the plane. And the tail gunner called up and said, no. There's a shock wave, and here comes another one. The shock waves were visible. Yep. And after we were sure we weren't going to get any of them, we turned to see what had happened. We could make absolutely no visual observation. The entire city was covered with dust, smoke, everything like that. Large white column, you've seen pictures of, was up well above our altitude. And so we just turned around and went home.
Day's over. Let's go. Let's go have a beer.
Yeah, and I didn't even get a beer out of it.
When you got back to the base, were there crowds waiting for you?
The crowd waiting for us. There are now some of those pictures over there and everything. More generals than there were when we left. General Spots was there, by the way.
And Fairfield's named there.
That's right. And he was a good man. He was really a good man. Spots was there, and he gave Paul the DSC right away. And then we went up to debriefing with Spots and Giles and... there were at least six officers there of flag rank and this sort of thing.
When did the psychological impact or the realization that what you had done was something unusual? When the war ended? I mean, surrender was a few weeks after that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, but I don't think it ever really bothered to hit us and that sort of thing. I came back and led a very ordinary life. You know, I came back and went back to college and well, they made me go to the bikini test. That kind of ticked me off, but because I had to go over there. But basically, life was just the same. Didn't change it a bit. Now, there are one or two people in the group that thought that somebody owed them something because they did something special. Those are the people that are bothered psychologically.
When you came, was it your last mission in the Pacific?
Yep.
That was the last. Flew all those miles for one run?
Yep. That's exactly right. We went up into Japan later, though. We were in Japan. We were on the ground in Japan and everything of that type.
Did you ever go back to Hiroshima in all the years?
No, but we went back to, I was in Nagasaki, but not Hiroshima, no.
And when you came back to the States, what did you do with yourself?
Well, in the first place, we flew the pictures from the bikini test back, and then we, right after that, the brass weren't there, so they left me get out of the service. So I'm back, took a vacation, went back to school at Bucknell. Got my first degree in chemical engineering there at Bucknell.
And what'd you do after that?
Went on, got a couple more degrees, and worked for DuPont for 36 years.
Raised a family.
Four kids, yep. Four fine kids. One of them's a lawyer out in Pittsburgh now.
We'll forgive that.
He doesn't practice much law anymore, I don't think. Everybody involved had a lot of kids, and they all were very fine families. Behan, Farabee, Don, people of that type.
Dutch, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Dutch Van Kirk, who was the navigator on the Enola Gay.
J. Robert Oppenheimer was one of the creators of the atomic bomb, and he stated, in some sort of crude sense, which no vulgarity, no humor, no overstatement can quite extinguish, the physicists have known sin, and this is the knowledge which they cannot lose. And that's our show for today. The interview with Dutch van Kirk can be found on YouTube, where you can see more footage of Dutch talking quite matter-of-factly about his role in dropping the atomic bomb. You can also listen to Hibakusha, atomic bomb survivors, speaking about the aftermath on the ground after those bombings. Next week, we'll continue our coverage of Nuclear Free Future Month and take you to two events, one to urge creators of video games to stop making these computer games that are used to recruit our youth into the military. The other event takes place at the Lawrence Livermore Lab in California on August 9th. For more information about both of these events, go to the website for Nuclear Free Future Month, www.nuclearfreefuture.org. Music today by OMD with Enola Gay. As always, you're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future. That's susan@raisingsandradio.org, or visit our website for other shows, www.raisingsandradio.org. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stamford, FM 90.1.
It's never out of